it's a, we have a paper in FISREV letters that's short with these collaborators. And then we've posted a very long one, which is probably submitted somewhere with these collaborators, and we're writing another long one because there's a lot of stuff to develop in this area. I'll give somewhat of an introduction. This is a string theory that we compactify, starting with 11-dimensional M theory, compactify to 7 dimensions. So I'll go through some of the stringy arguments and then talk about how we achieve some of the goals that have come to be understood as really important if one's going to have a chance of making physics out of the string theory. So you have to stabilize the moduli, so-called. That's all of the different parameters of the theory that describe how different submanifolds have certain sizes and how they're related to one another. And break supersymmetry, you have to do something to show that the cosmological constant problem doesn't get you in trouble. And then you want to calculate various properties and see how far you can go. And we'll go down to doing some of the phenomenology. The basic point is that 11 minus 4 is 7, and we know that you can write M theory in 11 dimensions, and we know we live in 4, so it makes sense to compactify in a 7-dimensional manifold and see if you can do something with that directly. There's a lot of earlier work going back about a decade, actually not a lot by string theory standards, going back about a decade. Most of the earlier work has to do with standard model physics, such as embedding the gauge groups in a string theory and getting chiral fermions and looking at some of the ingredients you need, Kähler potentials and such things. And there's a series of papers listed here by a small set of people. Bobby Acciari is one of our collaborators, and Witten and people have done a lot of work on this subject. Recently, two papers a couple weeks ago were posted by Bergeli, and there will be a third one this weekend on how to do these embeddings and how to generalize this stuff. This is not what I'm talking about. We're just going to assume for our work, which is, I'll describe what we, our aim was, we're going to assume this kind of stuff, use some of it, but not try and improve it or make any profound connections to any of it in detail. We'll just assume that you can successfully embed an SU5 theory, and we'll work with that as an example, but that's that there could be a lot of improvement in those other areas. What we do is assume we can construct a microscopic G2 manifold, and I'll talk about that. That's not a solved problem. We then start with a theory at the Planck scale where we compactify on that G2 manifold, and we want to generate the electroweak scale from a Planck scale theory. That is, start with a theory at 10 to the 18 or 19 GeV, and generate our 100 GeV scale in a vacuum that is de Sitter and metastable and has spontaneous supersymmetry breaking. We want to show that we can stabilize all those moduli. If you can't do that, you can't calculate anything, because you could calculate for some value of the moduli, but if their value runs all over and can be anything, then you can't trust any calculations. We want to show, it's important to us to show that it's consistent with standard gauge coupling unification, which is one of the main clues we have about what the world is like. And then we assume a natural grand unified theory visible sector that is an MSSM one, and we make predictions in that framework, and we can certainly do that, and I'll show you how that works. With only the Planck scale input, then, we are able to get, for the first time I know of, a real theory that where we don't put in any fine-tuning or any small numbers, and we generate a weak scale in a stable way. The philosophy of string theory in general is that you every string theory has many solutions. The philosophy is that you look for solutions that might describe your world, our world. And so we're going to isolate a set of solutions that seem to have the possibility of doing that. There will be lots of other solutions that may or may not describe our world. For example, we'll repeatedly make supergravity validity assumptions. We'll assume that we can work in a supergravity in a domain where supergravity is valid. There may well be solutions where our criteria for its validity, which are very conservative ones, are not satisfied, but that are still good solutions. We simply don't know that yet. So let me turn to some of the stringy things then. These are all things that are already known and used, and I'm sort of an amateur string theorist, so if you have questions about this part, I can try and answer them. But we're just taking all of these things under this and the next couple transparencies slides from older work. So seven dimensions are known to be able to form a space with G2 holonomy, and it's known that that can preserve supersymmetry in four dimensions. In all the string theories, you have the possibility of putting in what the jargon calls fluxes. That's just analogous to electromagnetic fields that can live on the submanifolds and grains of the theory, and in general they're quantized amounts in a way similar to how the Dirac monopole works in electrodynamics. It's very important for us that we don't use any fluxes. All the other examples that have been talked about for the last 5-6 years for constructing string theories with stabilized moduli use fluxes. The problem is that the natural scale for fluxes is the unification scale or the Planck scale, something around there. And the moment you use fluxes, all of your mass scales are naturally at those scales. And all of those theories that use them to get small numbers have to do something drastic, some fine-tuning or some special thing. So we're eager to avoid them, and we succeed in avoiding them. So that's an important part of what we do. In these kinds of G2 vacua, then, it's known from those papers, for example, these going back to 98 even, that non-abelian gauge fields will be localized at three-dimensional submanifolds in the seven-dimensional G2 space where there's an orbifold singularity of some sort, and that chiral fermions are localized in points where there are conical singularities. And there's a series of papers one can read about that. Also, generically, that is normally, although there could be a special case, generically, if you have two three-dimensional submanifolds that are hidden sectors in this or hidden invisible sectors, they won't meet each other in a seven-dimensional space. So in general, no light matter fields that are charged under the standard model and some hidden sector where we break supersymmetry will interact in any way but gravitationally. So supersymmetry breaking is generically gravitational in this kind of theory.
So by that, do you just mean that the chances of them intersecting are small?
It won't happen. Yes, it won't happen. You won't mediate any interaction normally in the theory. So you might be able to construct a special case in which you force that, but if you just leave it alone...
But is it just a volume argument, or is it deeper?
No, it's just a volume argument. There's a number of mathematicians who've constructed examples of G2 manifolds without singularity. So there's actually a fair amount known about those. They don't do particle physics any good at all because we need the singularities to have gauge groups and fermions embedded. There's a little bit known about that. There are a lot of dualities with heterotic and type 2A string vacua that suggest the existence of the singular G2 cases. And you can actually, it's been done that you can extend Kovalev's constructions to include the Orbifeld singularities and generate Yang-Mills fields. That's again in those papers that I showed you. And you can come at M theory from either the type 2A side or the heterotic side and make duality connections. So as far as I know, string theorists are basically agreed that there will be a global manifold having the G2 holonomy results, and we'll be able to construct the kinds of singularities that are needed and specify all of the string-based parameters that are needed, but it has not yet happened. Given this kind of argument, we expect that we can go ahead safely and do this and sort of work at it from all sides at once. So now I'm turning to the kind of work we do. We're interested in the moduli stabilization. So I'll write all this explicitly for you, but here's what's going to happen. In G2, the moduli fields are complex. They have real and axionic parts. The axionic parts have shift symmetries, which in our sector with no fluxes can only be broken non-perturbatively. And non-perturbatively basically means Gugino condensations, which I'll show you an example of, or instant odds. We focus on this not because this won't happen, but because we don't need it to succeed at what we're doing. And so when it's included, it'll add some substance, but we ignore it for now. The main important physical point will be that the gauge kinetic function in M-theory depends on all the moduli generically in a symmetric or equal kind of way, which is not the case in other string theories. And that's what lets us succeed in stabilizing all of the moduli. So we'll explicitly stabilize them in this case. We take then a set of Kähler potentials that are consistent with being on a manifold with G2 holonomy, and where there's some explicit but not quite general examples that have been written down in these papers. So the Kähler potential is given by this simply in terms of the volume of the seven-dimensional space, and the volume is a product of a number of factors with the moduli raised to certain powers AI. The AI have a stringy condition that is specific to the G2 case, so the fact that this is 7/3 and not some other quantity affects what we do. And they're the powers here, and those AIs are then characteristic of the G2 compactification and will help determine the physics in that. In more general cases, of which we have studied no examples yet, you know that this has to be this can be multiplied by some function that has certain known properties. We will assume that there are hidden sectors which are three-dimensional submanifolds, and in those hidden sectors you get Gugino condensation. That's an old standard kind of thing in heterotic theories, and what we assume is just like in the heterotic theories since the middle 80s. But it looks different here, it works differently, because the superpotential depends on the gauge kinetic function, which I'll show you on the next slide, and that depends on all the moduli. In practice, we look at a few things where we can keep the sum of terms. Mostly, though, we just look at two terms. So all the explicit formulas I give you will have typically two terms, which is enough to be completely non-trivial, but we can still do a lot of calculations semi-analytically and keep track. The B's in this are the inverse of C's, where the C's are what my mathematical friends call dual Coxeter numbers. They're essentially the ranks of the gauge groups that are causing the condensation. And the A's are constants that are of order unity and depend on the threshold corrections in the actual examples, and a whole set of them have been computed in the paper by Friedman and Witten. So the gauge kinetic functions have been shown to be expandable, writable as linear combinations of all the moduli, Zi, with integer coefficients Ni for each of the gauge kinetic functions. So the parameters, little a, which were in the volume expansion, and the b's, which are in the superpotential, and the a's in the coefficients in the superpotential, and these n's, once you have a G2 manifold and you know the mathematics of it, then you know all of these things. In practice, we don't know any of them yet for realistic examples that definitely have chiral fermions and gauge groups and everything. But we know them for examples piece by piece, and we know the constraints on them and such things. So we will take examples of this, and we will sometimes vary them and study them to see what happens. We'll focus on one particular case where the two hidden sector gauge groups have the same gauge kinetic functions, which is actually a fairly well-motivated class. As long as they have certain mathematical properties, then that happens a lot. So it's not too artificial case. In addition, generically, in hidden sectors, there will be chiral fermions in all the sectors, just as in the visible ones. And that's been studied all the way back to the 80s. And we'll include those, and they'll actually play an important role, it turns out. So when you do that, the superpotential gets changed. So a term that I wrote without this phi will pick up a meson field from the condensation of those chiral fermions, which is in general a complex meson field. And we take the formulas from the earlier literature, mainly Seiberg's and Clavier's papers. So we then we need a Kähler potential also for the meson field then, and one can try and do more complicated things there. But it seems reasonable to say that since we know that the fermions are at point-like conical singularities, that the bulk matter Taylor potentials should be slowly varying, so we can take a canonical normalization for those. So we just use a standard Taylor potential there. We do check that we can put chirofermions in both the hidden sectors we typically use, and we can use more chiral families in each, and there are no change in the results, and that's already in the large paper. But the example I'll give you just has one chiral field in one hidden sector because the equations are simpler. So then you have a Kähler potential and a superpotential and a gauge kinetic function. Then we assume that we're in a domain where you can have valid supergravity calculations. So given those three functions, then there's a standard set of techniques to construct a scalar potential in supergravity, and here it is after lots of calculations. You can write it out, and it depends on all sorts of those things that I described to you in complicated ways. And you can minimize this potential with a lot of work. And you make certain approximations. We check them. I think there's nothing that can be wrong with how we minimize the potential. We make expansions in inverse volumes and check results. The moduli are then stabilized at values that depend on those powers, A, that were in the seven-dimensional volume, and the integers in the gauge kinetic function, and a function nu. The P and the Q have to do with the ranks of the condensing gauge groups. And you get a function like this, and the scale, the meson field is also solved for at the minimum. You get a square root here when you do that, which means that the difference of two of the ranks of the condensing gauge groups has to be at least two. It's greater than two. And the minimum you get is actually a metastable de Sitter minimum for those following that kind of field. It would have been metastable even if that weren't fashionable right now. If you have a given set of those microscopic parameters, then it would be a unique minimum. And it's important for it to be de Sitter that you have that positive F term VEV from the scalar field.
Could you say once more again what the role of the scalar field is? Somehow I lost track of that.
You generically should just include it, but it turns out that its F term VEV is fairly large and positive, and so it's basically canceling the minus 3 times the superpotential squared in the potential to give you a de Sitter minimum. It's big enough to do that at the minimum. I mean, you calculate it, and it turns out to be big enough to nicely do that.
Okay, but is it something that would automatically come from this kind of G2 theory? You would have, in general, lots of them? Or
well, all hidden and visible sectors in string compactifications have generically the possibility of gauge bosons and chiral fermions, and when they can be there, they normally are there as far as is known. So again, it's the generic standard thing to include them, and so we would have, but then it turned out, we didn't know that when we started, but it turned out that it's crucial to give you the de Sitter minimum.
Right.
So now we want to definitely include it.
But in the general G2 solution, you could have, do you know for sure that there's no G2 solution?
No. That's not.
So you're just assuming that the G2, just that there is a G2 solution with at least one of these scalars.
You bet.
Yes,
But remember that when you're doing string theory, the point is always to find classes of solutions that might work.
Right.
And since it is the normal thing, we're pretty safe that it will be in some.
Yeah, okay, just
yeah.
Status.
So
okay.
Crudely speaking, the potential looks like this. Where you can calculate where the minimum is, and that's a order twice the gravitino mass. Just imagine some complicated moduli direction space. And it's metastable in that at infinity it's lower, but that's we have not calculated yet the tunneling through this barrier, but it's probably pretty safe. And the natural value at the minimum of the potential is the geometric mean of the gravitino mass, which we'll calculate in a minute, and the Planck mass. So it's around 10 to the 10 GeV typically. You can look at the potential and explicitly see the leading condition for the energy density at the minimum to be positive, so it's de Sitter, and that's very typical and easy to satisfy. And if you have an equality, which I'll come to in a minute, that would make the potential vanish at the minimum. So the exciting, or one of the exciting things that comes out, is that about 30% of the entire parameter space, where we define that, so the number of moduli is fairly large, because that's supposed to be typical in these theories, and where supergravity approximations are valid, has a gravitational mass less than about 100 TeV, which puts you in the electroweak regime. So without putting in anything but the Planck scale, you get that. I'll show you how that works in the next slide or two. In addition, I'll show you that we find a result that surprised us. You can see why it happens finally, that Gugino masses are suppressed compared to the gravitational mass just by string-based factors, not by anything in the low-scale theory, by a big factor. And that's, we understand why that happens in the theory now. No, I didn't know I did that. Okay. So you have to deal with the cosmological constant problem in some way when you do any calculation. And there's a set of string theorists who look at the scalar masses or the M3 halves and see a V0, which is the value of the potential at the minimum, and won't let you go beyond that point in your talk because that'll color all the masses and they don't trust anything you do. So in order to deal with those people who you can predict will be in the audience in certain places, you still have to do some work. And what we do is set the potential at the minimum to zero instead of the natural value that it's going to have by assuming we can tune those coefficients, which depend on all those integers, so we probably can, but again, we have to prove that eventually by a construction. And we explicitly check, and I'm not going to go through it here because it's once you check it, it's not so interesting, but it's in the paper, so we can look it up if you want. But we check numerically that you can calculate a set of superpotential masses when the potential is in its natural minimum, then you can tune it to zero, recalculate, and the changes in the superpartner masses and the phenomenology are negligible. It does not affect things, and you can understand why in detail from the form of how that works. Then we got a surprise, so we're actually going to now spend a few minutes studying these solutions where we tune the cosmological constant to be negligible. We'll assume that the mu parameter comes from a Judici-Mazzero term for these studies a little bit. And again, we're just taking a standard grand unified MSSM sector, which we assume is broken by Wilson lines the way it was in those earlier papers. We'll impose or look for radiative electroweak symmetry breaking. So you break the electroweak symmetry now and explain the Higgs mechanism. And we will see that we have to impose a lower bound on the Giugino mass, and that's important. And we want precision gauge coupling unification if we can, because that's been a problem to get. So then we compute the gravitational mass, and you can write it again in this fairly general approximation we wrote. You can write an explicit formula that depends on, so there's the Planck mass, and then the coefficients in the superpotential and the gauge group ranks, and the integers that were in the integers in the gauge kinetic function and the powers in the volume, and they depend on the meson field at the end there, which is stabilized at this value at the minimum. And the surprising thing that came out is that we then make reasonable choices for some of the parameters and scan the rest, and vary some of the reasonable choices, we find only low-scale solutions. That is, setting the cosmological constant to zero led to a case where there are no solutions in the entire string theory with a larger M3 halves than what we find, and there are plenty of solutions like that. So we understand that mathematically, but we don't yet understand physically what's going on there. It's fairly amazing, I think, that that happens. The basic, what's happening is that you would think you would have to independently tune the cosmological constant to be small and check you could do phenomenology and set M3 halves to be in the TeV region. In fact, you only have to do one of those and you get the other one coming out. And that's surprising still. What's going on to make M3 halves small is basically just the old non-perturbative effect that you get a 1 over g squared, e to the minus 1 over g squared, from gauge Enel condensation. So the scale at which you get that, call it lambda g qualitatively, that depends on the imaginary part of the gauge kinetic function divided by the rank of the gauge group that you look at in a little detail. When you get, you can see it analytically, when you get the cosmological constant tuned to 0, then you get another condition. And so that factor, lambda g, you can calculate, and it ends up at about 10 to the 14 GeV. And the ratio of M3S to M Planck, just coming from the fact that superpotential is cubic in that ratio, is that quantity cubed then. And lambda over M Planck is around 10 minus 4, so you get a factor of 10 to the minus 12. And the volume is bigger than 1, and the combination of those factors then gives you a number less than 100 TeV in a very natural, clean way without any small numbers or any tuning of any kind. So now let's look at the detailed calculations you get from the supergravity, and we're getting closer to the phenomenology for those who prefer that part. So you can calculate within supergravity. The gauge Enel masses do an interesting thing then. You calculate the gauge Enel masses, they again depend on those numbers that should look familiar now, times M3 halves. And this factor that comes out in front that depends only on the superpotential and the hidden sector condensation factors, the P has to do with the rank of the condensing gauge group, for example, and is a number like 20 or 30, and Q is bigger than P, and so this number is actually pretty large, and in the example of setting the cosmological constant to 0, that number is about 1 over 40. So you get gauge Enel masses that are suppressed compared to M3 halves by a factor of about 40 in that case automatically. And it's not, that factor is not depending on your low scale numbers or anything. It's purely coming from the string and hidden sector properties. I'll come to the phases in a minute. We can talk about the phases too here in a nice way. But we know that there are also other contributions to gauge Enel masses from the anomaly mediated ones. Those have been calculated in general in the 90s. So we take the completely general anomaly mediated pieces. Our contributions from Kähler potential and other things can be included to some extent. KK threshold effects are actually zero when you work it out here. And some of the Kähler potential things we can include. We don't have a Kähler potential for the G2 manifold, but there are type 2A Kähler potentials that have been calculated that can, where you can use some of the duality dictionary and basically estimate what that Kähler potential would be for the M-theory case. So we do that using this paper, which calculated it for the 2A theory, and get a number. And surprisingly, again, another thing that was surprising to me and I think all my collaborators, since none of them have been able to explain to me why it's happening, but we've checked it 8 different ways and it's a fact, is that the anomaly-mediated gauge Enel mass contributions and the sort of tree-level universal gauge Enel mass contributions from the supergravity, which are really coming from different parts of the physics in significant ways, are very close to being the same. And so you get big cancel.
Does that have any relation? I mean, the simplest thing is to have the anomaly mediated stuff plus just the universal size. Is this more complicated than the universal size dilaton approximation?
We don't have that at all.
We don't have that at all. So is there any way of relating that to?
No, it's not even connected, as far as I know. We have a completely different case where that's a case where one modulus dominates.
Right,
we have all the moduli,
no moduli,
and you can see the role of them all here.
Yeah.
It's completely different kind of physics coming in. The supersymmetry breaking is very different here with the gauge Enel condensation rather than assuming some F-term VEV in that case typically. It's unrelated to that. But the size of the universal terms and of the beta function proportionality anomaly mediated ones are the same. So you're getting, for example, here's zero when you combine everything, and M2 goes through zero at a point. The anomaly mediated ones depend on the unification gauge coupling. So if they're canceling at one point, they won't at another slightly, and they're very sensitive. So here's alpha unification inverse, which is around 26 or so. And you can see that there's a region where M2 cancels and then it's not. So M3 is basically the gluonal mass, and M2 the luonal mass, and M1 the amino mass.
So you used the word universal, so these other contributions are...
The other ones are universal because...
I
was trying to say that we put in a universal SU5 gauge group, so they're automatically universal. If we change the gauge group, they won't be. But
so that's where that
we're assuming this MSSM SU5 embedding that Witten studied, for example, and so they're automatically universal. That's not a crucial part of the input theory, but the basic feature will certainly persist in all cases.
Mm-hmm.
So the specific values of the masses may not hold up if you change the gauge group. And in Bourgeli's papers, for example, he's tried to embed something like an E8 group and then have it split under the effects of the manifolds and the group theory and the string theory so that you actually get, you don't have any arbitrariness in what your different gauge groups are at what stage and so forth. And he even claims you get three families automatically if you start with a single E8 embedding. So it's a very strong...
Does he automatically go through SU5 as a substage?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But you have enough other stuff so that you get modifications to the masses. But yes, that's not been studied very much. So, so then when you want to get gauge coupling unification, you will have, for sure, some threshold corrections, and Witten has estimated some of those. So we try, and they're not at this stage precisely calculable, but so we parameterize them and allow sort of 10-15% variations and ask, is there a region where we get precise two-loop renormalization group running gauge coupling unification where the theory and the phenomenology, the data run up, give the same answer? The answer is yes. If alpha unification is in this sort of region, there is a set of threshold corrections which are reasonable and can be checked against any specific calculation when someone's smart enough to do it. And for that, you get a set of gauge eno masses then that are in this region. So you automatically get, in this region, a Wino LSP for that case, and certain rather small values of the other things which you can then play with. The scalar masses have the contribution from the cosmological constant, which we've set to zero, and then stuff proportional on 3/2. And the leading term in this example we're using is 1, where there's no flavor dependence at the high scale and so forth. And then this is the same term that was suppressing the gauge eno masses by a big factor. There's a lot of other stuff, but it's all suppressed by a big number. So the scalar masses are 1 to, are equal to M3/2 and 1 to a very good approximation in that case. Or here it is reduced a little bit. Universal heavy scalars of order M3/2. The trilinears are similar to that, and there's a numerical factor which is just a little bigger than the scalars are. The AT actually will run down to a smaller number. We're going to end up in a minute with M3/2 in the multi-TeV region, so AT will actually run, because it runs so much, down to a smaller number, but still not so small.
So the previous scalar masses were those at the gut scale?
No.
Yes,
but they're going to run down, yes.
I know, but just formally.
This is all, yes.
Gut scale.
Right, that's high scale. The mu parameter is, of course, always a big issue in any string theory. The mu parameter gets a bunch of contributions. The physical mu parameter gets some contribution from the superpotential and some contribution from the Kähler potential in the context of the string theory. And then if you have an extended theory with U1 groups and scalars, and Jack is the world's expert on that subject, you get additional contributions to this. We can also calculate, if we have all these contributions, we can fully calculate the soft-breaking B-mu parameter. In Witten's papers, he has exhibits discrete symmetries that set this term to zero. So we assume it's all coming for this for what we've done so far from the Higgs bilinear coefficient, which is M3/2. So mu will be of order M3/2 if it's coming from a Giudice-Mazziero mechanism in these theories. We can calculate the masses at which the moduli are stabilized. They're about twice m3/2. If we actually assume that the, all these a's are equal to a common value to do a simple calculation, then we can diagonalize the moduli mass matrix completely, and you get all the values equal to about twice m3/2, except one outlier. I wasn't sure if that meant something, but Liam McAllister tells me it's a property of random matrices, that if you have those kinds of matrices, you always get one big eigenvalue like that. So we haven't finished this kind of checking, but it looks like we're okay on gravitino and moduli problems, not screwing up Big Bang nucleosynthesis. So now let me turn to some of the phenomenology. I more or less said it about gauge coupling unification. We just look very precisely into a full two-loop analysis and check that there really is a good gauge coupling unification. The phases are interesting. So here's the superpotential. In general, these threshold factors and this meson field can have phases. At the minimum, if you memorize that huge formula for the scalar potential, factors like this have to be zero, and they depend on those phases, and there are effectively two of those, so you're left with one combination of the phases in the superpotential. The gaugino masses are proportional to derivatives of the superpotential, so the same phase will come out when you look, having the derivatives doesn't change that. The anomaly mediation pieces are also proportional to the superpotential or derivatives, and the trilinears, and it's actually very complicated to see for the trilinears, which don't look like they're proportional to this phase when you write them down, but when you start putting in all the information you have, they are. So all of that stuff has one common phase coming from the superpotential and depending on the stringy kinds of factors. Mu can have a different phase from the Kähler potential. And so there is, in the theory, normally a relative phase between mu and this. One high-scale phase in the theory at the level of all of this part of the physics. And b mu is calculable and has the same phase as mu if we use that Giudici-Mazzero mechanism where it comes from the Kähler potential. This stuff is high-scale. There are corrections to the Chargino mass of order mu. There's a Higgs-Zeno-Higgs mixing term in the Chargino mass that's proportional to mu. So that introduces a change in the phase of the Gaugino mass at low scale, which is of order the leading terms. So you can do, though, a complete analysis of the phases of all of this stuff outside the Yukawa sector. In the Yukawa sector, the phase structure has not yet been studied. The papers I mentioned that deal with the phase structure by Witten and Acharya and collaborators do not try and get the CKM matrix or the Yukawa phases out of that structure. And so there will be potentially different phases in the Yukawa case coming from the instanton contributions to the light, particularly the light fermion masses. But that part of the theory has not been studied. However, here the phase structure is nice and interesting, and there is one non-trivial phase coming which has to describe everything that can come outside the Yukawa sector. In particular, we know the Yukawa sector cannot describe baryogenesis. And so if baryogenesis is coming from an underlying string theory at that level, then it's got to have to do with this phase. You can check that you can get electroweak symmetry breaking. We can compute tangent beta from first principles.
What does the can mean? Are there conditions? Or is it automatic to get electroweak symmetry breaking? For electroweak symmetry breaking, or is it automatic that you do get it?
This is a minimal theory, so you can just write down the conditions and you can always satisfy them. But you don't. It's not automatic in the sense that many solutions don't have it.
Okay,
that's right.
Okay.
Things have to be. It's fine-tuned a little bit, and I'm coming to that.
Okay.
Basically, what happens is that the M3 has. I should have said that sooner, but I'll get there in a minute, I guess. M3 halves has to be in the multi-TeV region, and so does mu because it's proportional to that. And basically what's happening is that you could calculate MZ, but MZ would normally be a difference of two numbers that were multi-TeV, and so MZ would normally be, if we hadn't known what the Z-mass was, we'd predict it to be a few TeV, a couple TeV. So we wish we had solved that problem automatically, but no theory or model of any kind has generically gotten small MZs, and we're no worse off than other approaches there. So this, I think, is instructive that nothing emerged from the theory that solves that for us, and we're talking about studying other things that may help us, but we don't know that. This is the ratio of the Higgs to the Z mass, which is perfectly normal. So that all looks fine. It's a function of M3 halves, and M3 halves in these kinds of regions, you get ratios of the order of 1.4 up to 1.6. If we set the Z mass to its experimental value, then the Higgs mass is somewhere between about 130 and 150, 145, coming out of the theory. So the light Higgs of the supersymmetric theory is standard model-like in this case, and it is in that mass region.
So the high masses at high M3 halves are purely because the squirts are very heavy, or that's
right.
Correction?
No, just squirts are heavy.
Yeah, right.
The transparency of the slide that shows that got out of order, or I wasn't thinking clearly when I put them in this order or something, but we'll get to it in a minute. I'm sure it's there. So let me turn more or less directly to the LHC and dark matter phenomenology. An important thing from my view is that we've really demonstrated that we can start with an 11-dimensional string theory and make a satisfactory physics connection